Normally, when you turn on the news and you see aerial drone footage of a flooded town, the visual narrative is just incredibly immediate.
Right, it's super binary.
Exactly. We are presented with this completely binary story. You see brown, turbulent water swallowing up streets and people on roofs trying to, I don't know, rescue a soaked mattress or a TV.
Yeah, and the automatic reaction there, the one we've basically been heavily conditioned to have, is just pure pity.
Right.
Because in our everyday visual language, overflowing water functions as the absolute enemy. It's a physical barrier that just destroys everything it
This is
touches.
the worst case scenario.
Exactly. We operate on this disaster semantics, I guess you'd call it, where dry land equals civilization, safety, progress, and stagnant or rising water equals total tragedy, absolute loss.
It becomes the default setting for how we process environmental hardship, which makes this 2022 watercolor painting by the artist Jairo Duque so disruptive to Lizette.
Yeah, the piece titled Cuatro Piquetos en la Ciénaga.
Right. So we are looking at a single static image of a flooded Colombian swamp, and it just completely dismantles that whole disaster narrative.
Yeah.
So for you listening, our mission for this deep dive is to basically unpack how this one single image radically transforms our understanding of vulnerability.
And we're also going to look at the really strange translation process that happens when that raw, muddy message gets exported, right? From a studio in California to shiny digital screens thousands of miles away in Europe.
Okay, let's unpack this because the origin of the piece sets up a really fascinating contrast right off the bat.
It really does. Duke is depicting this highly specific local ecosystem, the Ciénaga Grande on the Caribbean coast of Colombia. It's this vast, complex body of water known for its stilt houses and communities that live directly over the swamp.
But he painted this piece in a studio in California.
Right, relying on internet references to reconstruct the scene. And the image he eventually created absolutely shatters that detached news drone perspective we just talked about. He proves that water doesn't just mean destruction, you know, it can literally serve as the foundation for life, and in this specific instance, for play.
Yeah, and to understand how this painting eventually traveled to high-end Berlin galleries, you first kind of have to ground yourself in the shocking, vibrant scene that Dickov actually puts on the paper.
Which is just so vivid.
It really is. We are placed right in the middle of the Ciénaga Grande. And right in the center of the frame, there is a group of kids playing a pachito.
Which is an informal, highly chaotic street soccer match.
Right, except the street is a literal swamp. They are playing with the water literally up to their knees. The goals are not, metal nets with white paint. They are just raw, uneven wooden branches stuck straight down into the mud beneath the water.
And in the background, you see those traditional stilt houses just hovering over the surface.
The whole scene is exploding with splashing water, physical tension, implied noise, and just this incredibly raw human energy.
But the sensory overload of that image demands that we cross a massive psychological barrier before we can truly see what is happening.
Yeah, because stepping into the shoes of an outsider, if I casually glance at an image of kids running through knee-deep swamp water to kick a ball, my initial instinct is still, oh, those poor kids.
Of course.
I immediately think of scarcity. I think of, the lack of a concrete park, the lack of municipal infrastructure, the lack of a manicured turf field.
Your brain reverts right back to those default disaster settings.
Exactly. It feels like a tragedy of circumstance.
But Duke anticipates that reaction. He deliberately sets out to invert what he calls the imaginary of scarcity.
Wait, imaginary of scarcity? You mean the assumption that just because these kids don't have a pristine, dry soccer field, their lives are defined solely by what they lack?
Yes, exactly. That we view their environment strictly as a deficit.
Oh, wow.
That is the core assumption he is attacking here. These children are not ignorant of their harsh reality, right? They aren't victims blindly splashing around in a disaster zone. The game they are playing represents this active, fiercely creative appropriation of an obstacle.
Right, they're using it.
For these kids, in the context of this specific match, the water isn't an indicator of poverty. It serves as the literal physical texture of their soccer pitch.
Which fundamentally changes the mechanics of the sport, if you think about it. If you think about the physics of playing soccer in knee-deep water, I mean, the ball doesn't roll along the ground, it floats on the surface.
Right, it's a totally different game.
And the drag on your legs. It requires an immense amount of physical exertion just to run a few yards. If you slide in for a tackle, you aren't scraping your knee on gravel or sliding on grass. you are throwing up a massive wall of heavy water.
They are reinventing their territory using the exact materials the environment forces upon them. I mean, if your world gives you permanent water and wooden sticks, then your stadium is built of water and sticks. Yeah. The painting forcefully shifts the narrative from passive tragedy to active resilience.
And here's where it gets really interesting, because the power of that shift in narrative isn't just carried by the actions of the kids in the painting. It relies entirely on the technical framing Duke uses to force you, the viewer, to look at them.
Yes, the perspective is key.
The perspective is incredibly low. The horizon line is practically at the water level. So when you look at this watercolor, you feel like the swamp water is about to splash directly into your face. Like you can almost smell the stagnant mud.
What's fascinating here is if we compare that to the drone view on the evening news, the contrast is just stark. The news puts the camera up in the sky, right?
Looking down?
Exactly. It places the viewer in a position of aseptic, distant superiority, looking down on the victims below. The viewer remains safe, dry, and emotionally insulated while observing people drowning or losing their homes.
But Duke doesn't let you do that.
No. By putting the horizon at the waterline, he alters that entire hierarchy of power. He strips away your dry, comfortable superiority. He effectively drags you down into the swamp alongside the players.
So you lose the privilege of being a detached spectator. You are forced to share their vulnerability rather than just observe it from a safe altitude. You have to emotionally process the harsh reality of that environment because the water is essentially at your own neck.
You are totally implicated in the scene.
Mm-hmm.
And to make the viewer feel that wet, muddy vulnerability, the artist had to physically recreate the harsh realities of that swamp right there in his California studio.
Which is wild to think about.
The medium itself carries the message. Duke selected a very specific 300-gram cold-pressed Arches watercolor paper for this piece.
Okay, I have to geek out on this for a second because for anyone who doesn't spend time painting, 300 grams is exceptionally heavy for paper. It's thick, sturdy material, much closer to a heavy cardstock than anything you would put in a printer. But why does the physical thickness of the paper-like, essentially cardboard thickness, matter so much to the philosophical argument of the artwork?
It comes down to the physics of the medium mirroring the physics of the environment. That 300-gram paper functions essentially as a heavy, resilient sponge.
Okay.
Because it's cold-pressed during manufacturing, it has its own microscopic topography, tiny valleys and peaks pressed deep into the cellulose fibers. So the paper had to physically withstand actual pools of water sitting on it in the studio without disintegrating or warping beyond repair.
Oh, wow.
It had to literally mimic the flooded ecosystem it was depicting, holding standing water just like the Cienaga Grande.
So the studio process basically becomes a microclimate of the swamp. Mm. The paper has to survive a flood before the painting can even be finished.
Exactly. And once that flooded surface was established, Duke used very specific Daniel Smith watercolors. These particular paints contain heavy minerals.
Like actual rocks.
Yeah, basically. Ground up minerals. So when applied to the wet paper, those dense mineral particles naturally separate from the water and physically settle into the microscopic valleys of that cold pressed paper.
Wait, really? So the artist is effectively forcing the medium to behave like the ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
The paint doesn't just represent sediment visually, it physically becomes sediment on the page.
Yes, it creates this highly textured, turbid effect that perfectly imitates stagnant, muddy swamp water.
Yeah.
The painting doesn't just look like a swamp. On a microscopic structural level, the materials behave like one.
That is incredible.
And the colors he layers on top of that physical texture push the narrative even further. The palette is dominated by incredibly heavy, oppressive swamp greens and murky browns. It feels like an environment that wants to swallow the subjects whole.
But then, piercing right through all that gloom, you have these strident, screaming reds and blues from the kids' soccer jerseys. It creates this violent, chromatic clash.
It really does.
Those warm neon colors represent the human energy, the friction, the literal roar of a goal being scored. They just refuse to be absorbed or muted by the muddy environment around them. It acts as a form of visual resistance.
And you see that same visual resistance reflected in the background architecture, too. The crude wooden posts used for the soccer goals perfectly echo the wooden stilt houses in the distance.
Oh, that's true.
It provides visual proof that the exact same architecture used for basic survival, keeping their homes elevated above the floodwaters, is being repurposed for joy and competition. But, you know, capturing all of that chaotic energy, the splashing water and the resistance, it forced Duke into an intense internal struggle with his own stylistic limitations as an artist. Because if you examine the painting closely, it is actually quite blurred.
Yeah, very much so.
The children lack facial details. Their arms and legs are reduced to, like, suggestive smudges of color. The whole scene feels almost unfinished, as if he stopped painting halfway through the process.
And leaving a piece in that state is a massive risk when you're working in a realist tradition.
Right. But it makes sense if you think about it like taking a photograph of a fast-moving soccer game with a really slow shutter speed. You inevitably get motion blur. Our brains have to intuitively complete that chaotic moving image.
Because if it were perfect, it would feel wrong.
Exactly. If he had painted every single water droplet and every eyelash perfectly crisp, they would look like fake statues frozen in a pristine swimming pool. Not kids fighting through heavy mud. The blur is the movement.
Well, we actually have access to Duke's own writings about this piece, which reveals a heavy amount of self-critique on this exact point. It's a rare, brutally honest look into an artist's internal struggle.
Really? What did he say?
He admitted that having so many blurry, smudged figures ran the risk of scattering the viewer's attention. He worried people wouldn't know where to focus their eyes because the chaos lacked a sharp center.
Wow. So he is openly criticizing the finished work that he put out into the world.
Yeah, and he also directed that critique at the background elements. He looked at the stilt houses in the background and noted they felt too rigid, too architectural. He wrote that he wished he had simplified them more, utilizing more smudges in the background to give the painting more air and atmospheric depth.
Seeing that level of vulnerability from an artist proves that the creative process isn't just some, you know, divine lightning strike of inspiration. It is a living, imperfect, deeply messy dialogue with the material. The artist is constantly negotiating with the paint, the water, and his own perceived shortcomings.
And that incredibly physical, tactile, muddy dialogue was about to face its ultimate test regarding translation, because this artwork didn't stay on that heavy, sponge-like paper in a California studio.
No, it did not.
It was ripped from its physical origins and sent across the globe in a completely different format.
Right. So in September 2023, the physical piece of 300-gram paper didn't travel to Europe. The painting was exhibited digitally. It was broadcast via the Artboxy platform onto massive, high-resolution screens at Galleria Nicoletta in Berlin.
A completely different environment.
So what does this all mean? I have to push back on this transition. If the entire power of this artwork comes from the microscopic topography of the paper, the physical pooling of the water, and the heavy minerals settling in the valleys like real swamp sediment, doesn't slapping it on a shiny 4K television monitor in a pristine European gallery totally strip it of its power?
It's a valid question.
Doesn't it reduce a painting about precarious, wet, raw survival into like an exotic screensaver for wealthy gallery patrons?
The risk of reducing raw survival to mere aesthetics is always present when moving art into a gallery space, definitely. The outcome here, however, was incredibly surprising, primarily because the digital format introduced a completely different physical interaction with light. Well, think about how you view a traditional watercolor on paper. The light in the room hits the paper, penetrates the translucent paint, hits the white cellulose background, and bounces back to your eye. It is entirely reflective.
Right.
But on a digital screen, the image is backlit. The light is projecting outward, directly from the image into your eyes.
Ah, so the glowing screen fundamentally changes how the colors behave.
Exactly. Duke noted that this backlighting gave the water and the swamp reflections a deeply enveloping, almost cinematic dimension. It made the turbid water feel deeper and more immersive. Those strident reds and blues of the soccer jerseys just leaped off the screen.
That makes sense.
And because of this intense, glowing presentation, the international audiences in Berlin people, who likely knew absolutely nothing about the specific ecological or political struggles of the Cienega Grande, bypassed the local context entirely.
They didn't need a geography lesson or a historical briefing on Colombian coastal communities to feel the impact of the image?
No, they instantly connected with the universal theme of raw human resilience. They saw the defiance of the game, the energy of the children, and the sheer will to play in a hostile environment. The digital light amplified the emotional core of the painting, allowing it to cross massive cultural and geographical boundaries.
But translating watercolor mud to digital pixels has to come with a technical cost, right? You can't blast a subtle water-based painting with artificial backlight without losing some of the nuance.
You can't, and Duke observed the cost of this translation himself. The intense artificial light of the digital screens washes out the mid-tones of the painting.
Oh, interesting.
The subtleties, the quiet gradients of the muddy water, they get erased by the sheer brightness of the backlight. To survive that digital environment, the artwork demanded much more dramatic contrasts. It required darker, heavier shadows and brighter highlights just to hold its shape against the glaring light of the screen.
So the painting itself had to become resilient to survive the screens in Berlin. The artwork had to adapt to its new, harsh digital environment in the exact same way the children in the painting had to adapt to the harsh environment of the swamp.
Exactly. And the fact that the painting survived that digital translation, that it kept its form even when washed out by gallery backlights, is exactly why it manages to avoid the two biggest traps of environmental and social art.
What trap?
On one side, you have the trap of pornomiseria, the pure, distilled monetization of poverty. It is drama manufactured solely to beg for pity. It positions the viewer above the subject, asking them to look down and feel sorry for the impoverished victims.
And then on the other extreme, you have the romanticization of poverty. This is the dangerous tendency to treat human struggle as something quaint, noble, or, you know, exotically beautiful.
Yes, exactly.
It's the mindset of looking at a flooded village and saying, oh, look how simple and happy they are playing in their swamp. It patronizes the subjects by completely ignoring the very real hardships they face daily.
But Quattro Picchietto in La Cienega firmly rejects both of those toxic extremes. It doesn't beg for pity, and it doesn't pretend the swamp is a paradise. It exists entirely in the fierce normalcy of play.
Right. And for you listening to this deep dive, this artwork proves that leisure, celebration, and joy are not exclusive to comfortable, dry, paved environments. Life engineers a way to celebrate itself, even in a fragile, flooded ecosystem.
Yeah.
Joy in these circumstances isn't a luxury. It functions as a necessary survival tactic.
That's perfectly said. And as we wrap up our analysis, I want to leave you with a thought that builds directly on the technical reality of those digital screens in Berlin.
Okay, let's hear it.
We discussed how the bright backlighting of those monitors washed out the nuanced mid-tones of the watercolor, forcing the image into extreme dramatic contrast just to remain visible. So as you look at your own phone or your tablet or your television tomorrow, ask yourself a question.
I'm intrigued.
How is the constant bright backlight of our modern digital media washing out the complex mid-tones of real human experiences? Are our screens conditioning us to only see the world in extreme contrasts of pure sensational tragedy on one end or romanticized filtered perfection on the other? It is worth considering if that constant glare is making us utterly blind to the quiet, muddy resilience happening right in the middle.
That is such a powerful thought to end on. Keep questioning the visual narratives you consume every day. Look for the mid-tones in the stories you see, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.